You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters Live. Welcome to the podcast that showcases the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, a TV presenter, and a gastronaut. This year, the Queen becomes the first British monarch to celebrate a platinum jubilee, marking 70 years on the throne. So today, we're going to look at the traditions and recipes of British royal celebrations of the past and ask why some dishes created specifically for royal occasions captured the public imagination while others didn't. From coronation chicken to Victoria sponge, many recipes have a royal connection. But we'll also hear about some that haven't found favour. And we're going to ask, just how central is food to a modern day royal celebration? I'm joined by two food lovers who've looked at the power, politics and pleasures of these great royal feasts. Food writer Mary Gwynne, founding editor of BBC Vegetarian Good Food, cookbook author and organiser of Penshurst Farmers Market. Hello there, Mary.
Hello, hi.
Great to have you. We've also got food historian and author Dr. Sue Bailey, monthly food columnist for The Lady magazine, a regular food history commentator in national newspapers, and a woman with a secret alter ego, appearing at food fairs and history festivals as legendary TV chef Fanny Craddock. Hello there, Sue.
Hi.
Just love the sound of you being Fanny Craddock. That's just so bossy. Right, anyway, let's get on with this, because let's start with the challenge. Fortnum and Mason have launched a competition to design a special pudding to mark the Jubilee. And I just wanted to know that if you were entering, what kind of thing would you come up with and what would you work on? Mary, would you sort of look at history or would you look at ingredients? Would you look to the past or the future?
I think I'd look at the lot, really, of course. I've actually done a recipe for a local publication.
Oh, well, there we are.
So it's a Jubilee trifle. And you think, well, trifle, bit, you know, old hat. But actually, lots of history. So I've made it with a syllabub.
Fantastic.
And a trifle. So two old recipes going back to Tudor times, but using strawberries and champagne, because those are two, apparently, of the Queen's favourites.
Oh, you've got me there. You've got me. That's perfect. I love the sound of that.
Yeah. But of course, the change that I would make is, instead of using champagne, I will be using Kent or Sussex sparkling wine, because we now have a booming, what a change between now and then.
Yeah, absolutely.
In 70 years, we have a fantastic, we're showing up the French sometimes, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And syllabubs and, you know, things like fools are very much, you know, part of our food history, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. And I mean, I think I'm sure Sue agrees, we could talk for hours about this stuff, because there's so much, you know, syllabubs, wine, cream, lovely stories about milkmaids. You know, people took their bowl of ingredients out into Hyde Park so that the milkmaid would milk the cow onto the bowl to make the foaming syllabub. I mean, wouldn't that be fun for the Queen to do?
Yeah, oh, yeah. I'd love to see that, that's for sure.
In a month's time.
Okay, Sue, what would you come up with, do you think? And where would you look for your inspiration?
Well, interestingly, my first idea was a gin fizz-soaked trifle, seven layers in a cut glass bowl, of course, with royal sovereign strawberries and perhaps a creme anglaise. Mm-hmm. And I know the Queen rather likes some form of chocolate biscuit cake, so I might sneak that in as a layer. Or I had an idea of a summer pudding, perhaps with a crown-shaped mould, and then sugar-frosted elderflowers, because they're sort of quite nice and seasonal, a bit like ermine around a crown.
And they're right there, beginning to come out now as well, yeah.
Or my other idea, which is not a pudding, but it's an old Victorian recipe, which is a Jubilee tea cake. And I've got a book that Mrs. Marshall wrote, and these were almond paste and tea-flavoured icing, and then the sides rolled in desiccated coconut and sprinkled with chopped pistachio nuts. And I think, you know, if you're going to go and take something like that to a street party, it might be easier than perhaps taking a trifle. But I do like the sound of Mary's trifle, I must admit.
Well, I like this. Turning into a fight. That's brilliant. So you're both on desserts and lots of sugar, basically, which frankly is all about national ruin. But hell, I'll let you off with that one. Okay. Now, there have been lots of specific competitions to make new dishes, marking royal occasions in the past. The obvious one really here to talk about is coronation chicken. Now, this was invented for the Queen's coronation in 1953. Mary, can you tell us the story about how this came about?
Yeah, this is a great story. Because I think most of us think two things. One, chicken, they must have picked it because everyone eats chicken. It was an everyday food. And secondly, it's what they would have had at the banquet. But both of those are wrong. Chicken at that time was a luxury. It was very expensive to feed a bird up for the table. Chickens were there for eggs. You didn't eat them, or you ate them when their laying days were gone. So that was a luxury. It was in the middle of rationing, so again, a treat. But this was not served at the Buckingham Palace banquet. This was Constance Spry and Rosemary Hume of the Cordon Bleu School in Wingfield, who had to come up with a dish that would feed 350 overspill guests, the ones they couldn't fit into the palace. And they had the challenge of serving this meal for 350 people in Westminster Hall with no catering facilities, no space. A huge challenge, amateur staff.
But the challenge is, that makes the opportunity, doesn't it? Because you're squeezed in and you have to come up with an idea. This is genius. Okay.
Yeah. And it's wonderful. And actually, what is also, they wrote the recipe for the first time in the 1956, their classic cookbook. And they said they put a tiny bit of curry spice in, but they would hope that none of the guests would know, because that would be much too off-putting to serve curry to such a mix of people. So, you know, it's a brilliant dish. Served cold, delicious. We still eat it. Fantastic. Using chicken, which is a treat.
Yeah, and one of my daughter's favourite thing, coronation chicken, still. And there's, so why? Why food and royalty? What's that all about? I mean, Sue, ridiculous feasts have always been, you know, a part of the monarchy, but it wasn't necessarily the inventiveness of them. It was the spectacle, the theatre of it, wasn't it? How come we've begun inventing dishes? I mean, the Queen doesn't cook. Well, how can we invent dishes around her?
I think it's the idea is to do something that's celebratory. And I think it's been intriguing because all the entrants for the platinum pudding competition, a number of them have tried to find out what does the Queen like best. And on the whole, she has a fairly sort of, I would say, standard diet, but she doesn't necessarily go in for extravagant ingredients. And when I was doing some research for the article I was writing for the Lady magazine on the platinum pudding, I was looking at some royal cookery books, and ones particularly printed in the 50s and 70s. And there was much plainer food there. Mm. So in one sense, the idea is perhaps to go back to things that are slightly more traditional rather than go overly extravagant. And I think a number of entrants, I've had a look at some of these online on Instagram and so on, some of them have been wildly complicated, very lovely, but very complicated.
So when do we start seeing people beginning to follow royal fashions in their cooking? Is it Victorian times?
No, I would say it was before then. Once recipe books began to become more popular, and before, if you like, in previous times, let's say in the 15th, 16th century, you know, cookery books were not available for the masses at all. But there was one lovely book that was called The Queen's Closet Opened by Sir Kenelm Digby, who was secretary to Queen Henrietta Maria. And she was a wife of Charles I. And this was in the 17th century. And she was, in fact, almost sort of hailed as a 17th century domestic goddess. OK, she didn't write it, but it was written for her by Sir Kenelm Digby. And it had medicinal and food recipes and went into a vast number of editions. So that was one of, if you like, the sort of starts of the popularising of recipes, and particularly the sort of link with royalty.
Yeah. And the initial sort of concept of the recipe was actually the receipt, wasn't it? The list of the stuff that had to be bought for the meal. That became something very different with instructions. But the sort of the full instructions that we get for dishes these days are very different from even sort of 150 years ago, where they'd say, cook your squirrel, and you think, but what? Eh? How do I start doing that? cook the beef. Well, what cut of beef? Those kinds of things have really changed, haven't they?
It's interesting because I wrote the WI Centenary Cookbook, and looking back at the recipes and how they're written at different times, at the earliest book I have of theirs, and I have about 200, is from 1921. And the fascinating one is actually, I'm sure we're going to talk more about it, but the Victoria sponge cake, where in the 1980s it says, weigh out equal amounts eggs, flour, sugar, butter, mix, put in tin, cook in oven at 350. That's it. And the thing is that it was recognised that people knew what to do then. And then you go the other way, where someone wonderful like Delia Smith, who talks you through every detail, we actually need both. Say something about the time.
And about the knowledge that people had and that you'd expect, which you can't rely on anymore. OK, so let's talk about Victoria Sponge and throw everything at it, Mary. Tell us all about it.
It's such a wonderful story because it reflects, like a great recipe, so much social history. So, for one, Victoria had a very sweet tooth. Apparently, and quite a few recipes were called after her. So we've got the Victoria plum, we've got the Victoria sponge. There was also a pea and a sweet suet pudding apparently named after her at the time. Mm-hmm. So what was happening about the same time as she came to the throne, mealtimes, ladies were getting hungry in the afternoon. The Duchess of Bedford at Beaver Castle started introducing serving tea, which was very trendy in the new cups and saucers, with little things to eat, little sweet things to eat. And Victoria and her ladies really liked this idea. It filled that gap between lunch and dinner. And they became incredibly fashionable. What they wore, tea gowns, what they served their tea on, the silver, the whole thing. So the Victoria sponge was first recorded then. And it also reflected what was happening. The Industrial Revolution had bought fine flour and sugar, because before you were scraping your sugar off your sugar cone and it was pretty laborious. So this one recipe reflects so much. The first recipe to appear in print was Mrs. Beaton, great Mrs. Beaton, for Victoria sandwiches.
Yeah.
But what I was really interested by, again, I had to research for the WI book, when did they first have a recipe that was called the Victoria sandwich? So the WI was started in 1915, a year after the start of the war. Lots of publications, but no reference to something called a Victoria sandwich until the 50s. Lots of recipes that are exactly that recipe, the equal weights, but only after 1956 in the book we've already talked about, the Constance Spry Rosemary Hume book, which has a recipe for Victoria sandwich. A year later, the first local WI book appeared, called Victoria Sponge. So it's, again, shows fashions. It disappeared. It was called in Victorian times. But again, as Sue said, there's been different times of interest. The 50s, the 70s, when I learned how to cook, the interest in history and where recipes come from. And so when I was learning, it was Jane Grigson, Michael Smith.
Yeah.
Lots of interest in syllabubs and cakes and baking. So it goes in waves. But the Victoria sponge is a great recipe. It's a great test of a cook. A good Victoria sponge, really simple ingredients, and you can make a mess of it.
I've screwed up many a Victoria sponge, I have to say. You kind of think, really? How can this happen? I'm not a baker. I'm a cook, but I'm not a baker. Okay, so let's go back to earlier days then. Royal meals weren't just about sitting down to dinner. They were about politics, and wedding feasts would be about royal dynasties coming together, and meals were about diplomacy and spectacle and a show of power and wealth. There's a coronation feast, I believe, of James II in 1685, and you can look at this up on the parliamentary website. And in the first course alone, there were 46 different dishes of hot meat. There was one dish which was 24 puffins served cold. Now, Sue, was this extravagance typical throughout history? I mean, has royalty and food always been about the spectacle?
To a certain extent, yes, I would say it was, because it sort of very much showed sort of power and effectiveness, and the fact that you could afford, as the monarch, the most extravagant ingredients. And so, yes, it was very much showing wealth. And it's interesting that you mention that particular feast, because this was after the restoration of the monarchy, which happened in 1660. And before that, the previous coronation was 35 years before. And that in between, there'd been a civil war, a regicide, abolition of the monarchy, interregnum. So basically a lot of fairly depressing things. So when that coronation happened, it was a very, very lavish ceremony. And the ceremony before James II's ceremony, which is the puffin one that you mentioned, before that was Charles II's coronation in 1661. And that was similarly lavish and also very political. So that sort of really made sure that the king was showing his authority and his majesty to his subjects, his allies, and also, of course, his enemies. So it was very much a sort of, well, this is who I am, and using a feast to show power. And I've got a lovely excerpt from of Samuel Pepys's diary, which said that he went to dine in to celebrate in Westminster Hall, and there were 10,000 people there. And the ground was covered with blue cloth, and it was fine hangings, fine scaffolds. And he saw the king come in, and then he saw the heralds leading people up before him, and the king's servant going to the kitchen to make sure that he tasted every single dish that went up to the king's table. So it was very much a sort of, let's present everything as sumptuously as we possibly can.
Hello there, only me. I just want to break into the conversation to say that if you're enjoying this episode, then once it's finished, you might want to check out the edition all about the origins of Easter food traditions. Just go to foodmatterslive.com and search Easter. And now back to the chat.
Now, a couple of years ago, I made a documentary for BBC Four all about restoration era food, and we made a stuffed calf's head, and it was spectacularly difficult to do. Well, first of all, you've got to lay your hands on a calf's head, which is really difficult. And my lovely butcher, Godfrey's around the corner, managed to get me a calf's head. Only had one ear, but that's fine. We dealt with that. You had to literally skin the calf's head, because you didn't need any of the bones. You had to take the entire face off the head, and then sew up every orifice, of which there were many. By the time we finished, and then stuff the whole thing with forcemeat. Now, I mean, it wasn't just extravagant in the recipe itself. It was the sheer difficulty and the mastery of, well, I say mastery. The mastery wasn't mine. The fact is, it looked like a horror show, and I'm sure they were more spectacular at the time. But these things, the difficulty and the ridiculousness of, you know, of serving swan and puffin and things like that is sort of part of it, isn't it? And Sue, is that about making the moment that much more special and that much more rare, or is it just, rah, look at me?
I think it's making it more sort of special and rare, because often, you know, special plates, special commemorative ware, obviously this is a later date, would be created to make use of this, but things such as swan and peacocks with gilded feathers and, you know, recreated wings with the stuffed heads, you know, supported on the animals, and again, potentially the whole animal being stuffed and then being dramatically carved in front of people was really important. And things such as the sort of various subtleties that they had at feasts, where when you if you plunged a dagger into the center of a pastry castle, you know, wine would come flowing out of it. So it was all about spectacle.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's the relationship between these feasts and the rest of us plebs? You know, the stuff that we're eating. Did the recipes and dishes, ingredients trickle down into society, or really were they symbolic and never really entered ordinary people's lives?
On the whole, they were pretty much symbolic. I mean, people wouldn't necessarily go out and do peacocks every single day by any manner of means. But also in terms of the different types of diets, basically was typically the quantity of meat that the upper and the lower classes actually ate. And so if you were upper class, then you would eat meat fresh or preserved meat, and you'd eat beef, veal, pork, lamb, mutton, chicken, duck, goose, pigeon, game, rabbit, venison, woodcock, pheasants and cranes. So basically whatever you could lay your hand on. But then if you were a common person, as it were, or let's say a commoner, then you would find that you would only be eating meat on special occasions, a lot more bread, milk, cheese, eggs. And again, things such as bread showed your status. So if you had a much finer, whiter loaf, you were of higher status. If you much more of the sort of the lower classes, then you'd have a barley bread or rye bread, so much darker brown or black in colour. So you could, again, visibly almost see the status of the type of food that people ate.
And a lot of the time, you know, the nobility would eat their food on something called a trencher, wasn't it? Basically a really tough kind of brick made of bread. And the juices and the goop would from their food would soak into it. And then often the trencher and any food that was left would then be handed out to the commoners. Is that right?
Yes, yes. It's in one sense, it's a, if you like, an early use of recycling, why not?
Yeah. Although very much the secondhand juices of somebody else's meal.
Oh, quite, indeed.
But yes, I take your point. Okay, now, Mary, one of my great, I would say my greatest ever mistake as a food writer was taking a chicken and gilding it with tiny thin layers of solid gold leaf. And my theory about this was it only actually cost a fiver to cover the entire chicken with gold leaf, because gold leaf is so small, and that if you're buying a bottle of champagne, you're basically paying £15 more than you should for a bottle of similar wine.
Ooh.
So that was my theory. This was published on the BBC's website, and I was roundly condemned as a complete tosser for doing it, which I accept now.
Yes.
That you know, it insensitive. You know, what about people in food poverty? So this brings us to a quite a difficult conversation. Really, these Jubilee celebrations are happening during a time of economic crisis for many. Price of food itself is rising. That, you know, Jack Monroe is constantly in the media at the moment, talking about how difficult it is for people to just make ends meet on a daily basis. Now, we have had royal celebrations during difficult economic times in the past. You know, Queen's wedding came just a couple of years after the end of the Second World War. Do we need to balance extravagance and celebration with a sensibility for what people are able to afford?
I think we do. And I as you were talking about the calf's head, I was thinking back to at the time of the Queen's accession to the throne 70 years ago, the country was suffering severely because of rationing still in place. And in fact, there was a recipe, the Kent WI produced a little, all the local counties produced their own recipe books. Kent WI in 1957, so a couple of years after the end of rationing in 1954, the first recipe in this is for sheep's head soup.
Ah.
And it's, you buy a sheep's head, you boil it for 2 hours, you then leave it to cool, you then take the bits off. I mean, this is a tiny little everyday recipe book, and it's making the point that, you know, peacocks and calves' heads for the rich, but the poor are having to buy basic food and what they can get, the poorer parts of society. So 70 years ago, we were coming out of a very difficult time and heading into a boom time. The 50s was an extraordinary time. But now we are suffering again from huge world events that have been outside our control. We've got wars going on, the pandemic. You know, after the First World War, there was the flu epidemic, pandemic then. So there are parallels. I think the interesting thing for me is the challenges that rationing was actually imposed throughout the war years, lasted for 9 years afterwards, but it was a very healthy way to eat. The population, the baby boomers who were born in that time, were incredibly healthy. And also everyone ate the same. So you might have had excess if you were a farmer to cream or butter or through the black market, whatever. But on the whole, the rich were as affected by rationing as the whole of society was eating the same. So now, I think that's the challenge. There seems to be a lot of inequality, and the choices that people are having to make at the moment, and yet we want to celebrate. I liked what Sue said. I think food is a thing. When people share food, still things have changed, but we get together to eat and celebrate together, you know, breaking bread together, sharing food together. We all haven't done that for the last couple of years. So there are a lot of symbolic things potentially going to be taking place.
Okay, that's really interesting, because I think that takes it onto a very different level, and which brings us to the sort of, I was going to say psychological, but it's really a sort of social concept of the need to celebrate, the need to mark a moment, and is that, you know, you could call it patriotism. I would say there are a huge amount of people in Britain that don't care about the monarchy, but will be celebrating in the way that non-Christians celebrate Christmas, that we have a need, and right now I think you're absolutely right, we have a need to come up for air and to feel some joy, and it almost doesn't matter what we're celebrating, we just need to come together. And that's a social tool, isn't it? Which again comes back to the concept of feasts. You know, they're not really needed, but they're important to bind society together. Do you think that's in a slightly more, not dysfunctional, but fractured society, do you think that that's still the case?
I think it's even more important. We actually have to work harder to do it. Because maybe in those days, I mean, they were eating turtle soup and fillet of lamb in the palace, and spam and corned beef and egg, dried egg cakes on the streets, having shared their rations, but everyone joined in. So what we're talking about now, I think we've got to recognise how important this is.
As a social tool. Okay, so Sue, talking about this, you know, when did street parties, this concept of the public feasting, when did these become part of national occasions?
Well, probably the most well-known start of the feast and the sort of idea of a street party was actually peace teas, which were held in the local streets for children to mark the end of the First World War in 1919. And then there was a celebration for the Jubilee of King George V in 1935, then coronation of King George VI. Again, there were street parties, and then for VE and VJ days at the end of the First World War. And so it's very much a sort of method of people getting together to celebrate things. Mm. And it was very interesting what Mary was saying, because in the coronation of Queen Elizabeth in 1953, the adults particularly served the children. And so that was one of the key things that was being made out about it.
I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And what was a typical menu then was sandwiches with fish paste or jam, blancmange and jellies, because these were a real treat. The children coming out post-war.
Wow. You've survived this far, but not any longer. Yeah. Wow. And children being part of it is really important as well, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. And I mean, particularly there were other examples of this. So if you go back previously in time, not so much street parties, but great feast-type parties. And in the Jubilee, the Queen Victoria's Jubilee, there were things such as Jubilee cakes, which were special buns made with dried fruit. And there was an open-air party for children in Hyde Park that year. And children were allowed half a pint of beer to celebrate the party. It was very interesting. They catered for an enormous number of children in Hyde Park. It was an Anglo-Australian firm that actually did the catering, and they provided 60,000 buns, 30,000 meat pies, 30,000 cakes, 30,000 oranges, 9,000 gallons of lemonade and ginger beer. And obviously this was the second celebration, because in the previous one that I mentioned, that was when the ale was consumed. And this is, again, thanks to Ivan Day, who does lovely food history research.
He's amazing, yeah.
And he said that a mathematician present, calculated if the buns, pies, cakes and oranges could be placed in a line, those extend to a distance of 9.5 miles. So that's quite a feast. I mean, that is pretty impressive. And then there's another lovely thing about ox roasts, because this was very much a tradition that was started up, and particularly in the Victorian times. So ox roasting, one of the methods of celebrating a jubilee is when the Queen Victoria had celebrations in honour of her. And that also, again, happened for Queen Elizabeth's 2002 and 2012 celebrations. So the idea of landowners providing oxen for people in the countryside to enjoy as a feast, this is a lovely way of thinking about, you know, how people can actually celebrate themselves. And also, as Mary was saying, there were lots of sort of traditional feasts that are happening up and down the countryside historically that happened and are going to be happening in the same way now.
Let's talk about now then. Mary, if you could reintroduce one dish from all this royal history and reboot it for now, what would it be?
I'm going to be a bit obvious and say coronation chicken. Because actually, I think chicken, it represents such a change in 70 years. Mm. It was a luxury. Most people would hardly have eaten it. Then it represented the changes in agriculture and farming and development when it became mass produced. And now they're saying in the news, it's going to be as expensive as beef. But actually, chicken should be a luxury. It's, you know, feeding an animal grain, which, you know, costs a lot to produce. I mean, I have, you know, two chickens and six bantams outside. Someone's having to try and keep them quiet at the moment because my rooster will be...
pinning them down currently.
Yes, absolutely. No, they'll make even more noise if you do that. But actually, you know, especially if you live, as I do, closely with chickens, they are fantastic animals. And also one chicken, one delicious, properly reared, slow-raised chicken that's out on grass, it tastes fantastic. It can feed a family. You should be making stock with it. The original coronation chicken was a roasting bird poached in water. You'd have so much from that. And, you know, so I think we've got to, it represents the history of our farming industry, socially, how the cooking skills that people have. And then again, from a health point of view, you know, mayonnaise has become a baddie and now it's a goodie again if it's made with olive oil and egg yolk. You know, it's why I say when I wrote the WI book, it was 100 recipes for 100 years and each recipe told a story. And it's why I love writing about the history of food, because social history, political history, you know, it's why we're here. It's wonderful. So yeah, coronation chicken would be my choice.
Yeah, I think you're right. And food is story, I think, then that's when it tastes best. Okay, Sue, reintroduce one dish from our royal historical recipe book. What would it be?
Well, that's interesting because I would actually agree in one sense with Mary, the flavour of a properly raised chicken that has enjoyed its life, is there's nothing more comparable to that than comparing it to a sort of flabby, a pale chicken. It's a beautiful bird. I totally agree. And I'm very envious of Mary being able to have those in her back garden. But an interesting one I came across was something called a poupeton, which is a name for a pie. And this was a baked fish and asparagus pie that was actually created for James's coronation. And I was so intrigued by the name of it. I just love the name.
Extraordinary name. Poupeton, yeah.
I know, isn't it lovely? And it could be used with layers of asparagus and different types of fish. And again, depending on whether or not you're using it from the sort of, if you like, original receipt or updating it with, let's say, salmon. I think I really want to have a go at creating that. So that's going to be my challenge.
Yeah. Okay, now this is a food industry podcast. So Mary, I mean, are these moments, I know that Easter and Easter eggs and Christmas are very important to the food industry, but can these big royal occasions be useful to the food industry? And, you know, have they been in the past and are they now?
They, of course they are, because people are want to know what to cook, where to get it. I mean, we'll all be rushing to the supermarket, to the high street, to the farmer's market.
For a mild curry.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, the mild curry that no one will notice. You won't offend them. So yes, of course. And actually, that brings up the fact for the food industry, you know, we're all quite insecure about food and cooking these days. I mean, I think it's fascinating. There is more information out there about food and how to cook it than ever before. Post-war, women had lost skills in cooking. Now we're all terrified. Food has become this really quite scary thing, I think, so much involvement. So yes, of course, for the food industry, I mean, there'd be opportunities all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so Sue, let's look at this, the Royal Jubilee this year. I mean, the articles have begun to come out. I think there are lots of people getting very excited about it. In what way do you think food is going to be a significant part of the Jubilee?
Well, I hope it is going to be a significant part of the Jubilee, because I think everyone is fascinated to find out, potentially with this Platinum Jubilee pudding, as to what is the one that's going to be chosen. How much is it going to reflect, you know, the 70 years of the Queen's reign? And is it something she really, really would enjoy? And so I think also that people are already getting up their Jubilee bunting to spread out and to plan the parties. And certainly in my local village, there are already a lot of plans afoot for exactly what's going to be happening. But I think this is where food is central as part of a celebration, because we love to get together, and what better way to do it with some food and drink?
Yeah, and I think what we've discussed, the idea that, you know, you don't need to be a massive fan of the monarchy to enjoy a social occasion where everyone gets together as we come out of COVID and all sorts of problems in the world and reflect on the fact that they still exist as well. Let's hope that it's a force for the good. Sue Bailey and Mary Gwynn, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, there are plenty more at foodmatterslive.com. For example, if you go to the site and search Ramadan, you'll find the episode where we ask if the UK food industry is missing an opportunity when it comes to the Islamic holy month. Follow to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And thank you so much for listening.